The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 149.
Doing laundry with authors on book tours.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And our special guest is Lauren Bukis. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, really quick, before we get into talking specifically about the book, big news apparently just came out the day we're recording this, which will be, this will drop tomorrow, the day of the release for the book, that apparently Leonardo DiCaprio's company has optioned and is planning to make The Shining Girls into a TV series.
That's right. We had a four-way bidding war, but Appian Way, which is Leonardo DiCaprio's company, and MRC, who made House of Cards, came in really, really strong, and I really just like their thinking, you know, and especially what MRC's done with the Netflix model with House of Cards. I'm like, that's really exciting, that's really forward-thinking, and that's kind of the way TV is going. And it's awesome, you know, instead of having like a two-hour movie, it's going to be like hopefully a 13-hour movie.
And it'd be really interesting because when I was reading the things, I mean, and you just said that one of the companies that is involved in this worked on House of Cards, and as you said, it went on the Netflix, which means it's possible this will appear on Netflix.
It is. You know, obviously it's such early days. You know, we haven't, you know, we don't know anything yet. They're going to be working on trying to attach director and scriptwriters. And that'll be kind of the next step forward. But so it'll take a while, but it's really exciting. It could be on Netflix. It could be on HBO. I'm just really excited to have people who are this passionate about it. And, you know, I think we can really kind of play with a lot of the elements of the book and push, you know, pull out those stories, draw them out even further, which would be really, really great.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like we're going to obviously get into this more in a little bit, but the format of this book is almost catered to television. It's just close enough, but obviously from your background and everything too, sort of, I suppose, makes some sense.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
It's very exciting. I don't really know how to feel about it. I do. I'm really super excited, but it kind of feels all very unreal. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Do you mind if I play Harper?
You can play Harper.
No.
How's
What? Then I have to be Dan. And I'm not that big a fan of baseball.
Okay, but what about Chetty? Chetty's really cool.
Yeah.
Kind of geeky.
Oh, or you can be Mal. No, you can't be Mal.
I kind of just want to have, like I want to win an Emmy just from playing, like, a serial murderer, and that I want my career to end after that, for action. Right. I just want that to be my one role. I want to be, like, Jay Davidson from Stargate, where his one role is basically the crying man and then the Stargate character, Ra. And that's it.
Perfect. And that sounds like a good career trajectory. You know, go out with a bang, establish yourself as the number one, whatever it is.
Serial killer?
Serial killer and get up.
Serial killer character actor.
Yeah, well, you could become a real serial killer. That would work too, you know?
No, I don't like blood.
Thank goodness for that.
And this is sort of the newer development. Obviously, way back when The Shining Girls was also... the book itself wasn't the result. It was the subject of a bidding war. And HarperCollins UK, for the UK side, actually snatched it up in what was at the time a pretty big deal for just having only released two novels, or at least two science fiction novels or fantasy-ish novels. And then suddenly here's this huge bidding war for The Shining Girls. And now here we are, you're releasing it. And what has this whole experience been like the last, say, year?
It's kind of been like an episode of The Twilight Zone, and I went back and watched a lot of them for research for the book. There's, you know, like there's so much research which goes into tiny details, and there's one chapter where Kirby the heroine is watching an episode of The Twilight Zone, and I had to go back and like watch all of them to choose the right one, and it's literally a paragraph. But, you know, it really feels like that. It feels like just I've been tipped into this kind of topsy-turvy world, and I've got to tell you, you know, Zoo City was about to go out of print in South Africa when I won the Arthur C. Clarke Award. When this whole bidding, five-way bidding war happened, or at least five ways and four ways, it sounds like really kind of weird sex stuff going on, but I swear it's not. But, you know, my husband and I were in a really bad place. The animation company we were working for had gone bankrupt, and we hadn't had work for like 5 months. I was writing some comics and, you know, like getting drips and drabs, but we were kind of paying our mortgage out of our mortgage. You know how you pay your credit card out of your credit card, you go to the ATM, withdraw money, and then put it straight back in? Yeah. That was kind of the situation we were in, and suddenly the big deal came through, and it changed our lives overnight. It's been incredible.
The good news is you deserve it.
Thank you.
Because you write
I'm
damn
sorry,
good books.
Was there bad news in any
of that? No, I mean the good
portion,
side, not
which
the
is never
first
fun,
part.
But...
Yeah, sorry, let me clarify. Yeah, I mean,
oh
it's...
God, what a, that's quite the whirlwind that
yeah.
you've
been on. Ah, you get to be one of the actual successful authors. How nice.
It's amazing to get paid to write full time, to make stuff up full time. It's really, really cool. I feel incredibly lucky.
I gotta say that I can't wait for the TV show.
Sue, I'm really excited.
Because I had to, both of us just finished this book today because we're slackers, even though we've had it. And I literally started it last night at about 11 o'clock, and I finished it at about 11 o'clock this morning because I did sleep for a little while in there. It is absolutely engrossing.
Thank you.
I have not been drawn on a journey quite so easily in quite some time, and I was kind of surprised by that given the structure of the book, but God, I'm skipping around, Sean. I'm sorry.
That's all right. No, but the book skips around, so I think that's fair
exactly.
enough.
Exactly. It's all appropriate. Do we want to go with
ask the question that's related to that, because you seem like you really want to ask that question, so go for it.
Because it starts out so quickly with the jumps. For our listeners, the structure of this is that a main character goes back and forth through time, but you also have a sort of, you have the locked in timeline, and then you have a jumping timeline. And I actually found it incredibly easy to follow, which was the part that surprised me, because one would think that with this much time hopping, it would be a somewhat confusing book to follow. How did you even keep track of all the nuances of the different timelines? And how did you sort of strike that balance between easy to follow and time hopping?
Well, I think it helps that each chapter starts with a date. So, you know,
there's a clue right there.
But, you know, like trying to keep it all in mind was really, really tricky. And I ended up kind of mapping it out on the wall above my desk. And it's kind of my murder wall. It looks like I'm a crazy person or I'm in Homeland or something. Because you have there are three different timelines. There's Harper's timeline, the killer, and he's jumping all over the time and, you know, as serial killers normally get more violent as they go on, and that's how you kind of figure them out. But he's more violent in like 1984 and less violent in 1993, so it's really tricky for anyone to kind of put that together. But then you have the actual historical timeline of the murders, and then the novel's timeline, which jumps between his perspective, Kirby's perspective, and all the Shining Girls.
You have the timeline of the house itself.
Yep, which is kind of an atemporal space.
You're still having to track, right?
Exactly, and Harper's life back in 1931, you know, because he keeps returning back to 1931, and that when he steps out of the house in 1931, the days carry on as per normal. But I also had to track the objects, because he takes an object from each girl and leaves it on a different girl. So he'll take a 1993 baseball card and leave it on a 1943 World War II welder. So I had to track where the objects were. And also the way I dealt with Harper was by just hurting him at every opportunity. But then I had to keep track of his injuries. I'm like, how is his jaw healing? I don't know. You know, I'm glad I broke his jaw. It made me feel better. But now I have to keep track of, is it still wired up? I don't know. So I had this murder wall. I also used Scrivener, which is just the best writing software on earth, because it gives you a visual corkboard display where you can see all your chapters and you can color code them. So I had them color coded to the different characters so I could see if I had too much of a heavy emphasis on Kirby or there were too many Harper chapters or if I needed some more Dan in there, who is Kirby's sidekick, I guess, and mentor. And, yeah, you know, I really had it mapped out visually, but with all these crazy red strings and yellow strings to track the objects and you know, photographs that I'd taken either in Chicago when I went there on a research trip or just evocative pictures I found online of everything from how you would wire a jaw in 1931 to, you know, what county fairs and girly shows looked like and kind of the facades that they had, which was very carnival. It was beautiful.
So I think that actually goes to one of the things that I really liked about this book was the fact that it's an incredibly visual novel. The language is very rich. Things are very, I mean, just in the beginning, when you start with the glow girl and her performance is one of the most vivid things, I think, in the entire novel, which is, I suppose, appropriate given the start of Harper. But now, and that makes sense given how you decided to track things with, you know, visual elements and whatnot. I actually stopped halfway through the book.
Yeah.
And this morning, because I woke up this morning and I was like, okay, gotta finish the book, and sat down. I like stopped myself and I was like, okay, now's a good spot. There was something that I lost track of.
Yeah.
And I sat down and tracked. I created my own timeline. This horribly scratched up piece of paper trying to go, all right, this is who we got this from. And he put it here and then he grabbed it back. And I became completely obsessed with the timeline myself, which is slightly difficult given how things actually track out. But I felt I had to know about the items,
yeah,
and the history of the items, because that's a really good point that you kind of that you're able to keep track of the timeline from those two things, the injuries of Harper and I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, that's
yeah.
It seems like that would be the easiest thing to follow is like, okay, I bashed in his face in this part, so. I know where he's going to have his bashed face, but it's like all the little knickknacks and all the little pieces. Like, when are things where they're supposed to be at given time? Because he's got a wall of basically of stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes things are there that were supposed to be moved. That he's like, there's a point, I think, in the book where he takes something from somebody else, but when he shows up, it's already there because he hasn't moved the thing to the person yet. That he's going to leave it on. Like,
well, I mean, all the objects are in the room anyway. It's kind of this space that's out of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there is a paradox there. But I was playing with that on purpose. And I sat down with two very, very geeky friends of mine and talked through, like, all the time travel stuff and whether I could have this kind of atemporal space where all these things exist in that reality, but also in our reality. Time travel, y'all. It becomes very confusing. But I tracked it very, very carefully. There is no looper moment where Bruce Willis is going to say, oh, I don't know how all this works. We're going to have to, like, work it out with straws and stuff, and we'd be here all day talking about it. I really did track everything very carefully.
Well, and I would say that this is a different kind of time travel film or book. Film, yeah. than I've read in the sense that it does feel like it's cohesive and that there is not that moment where, like, you've hit the crazy paradox and so you're just like wag your tush and that's it and it's over and we're all everything's fine again. It's a lot of time travel, anything does that, right? It never quite explains how all of this weirdness is going on and how you get out of that, but this doesn't have that problem. It's, you know, the only thing that I didn't feel quite explained and not it doesn't need to be explained is how the house is the way it is. But you don't need that information. That you just kind of accept it.
Well, it is there in kind of the final chapters.
I don't want to ruin that for people.
I know.
Shh.
But it is explained eventually, but in a very strange way. And but yeah, you know, I looked at different time travel models, but it always struck me that the most appropriate for this book would be fatalistic time travel, that you can't kill Hitler, you know, and the more you try to resist your destiny, the more you're going to set in place all the things which are going to make it come about. You know, it's classic Oedipus or Macbeth. You know, so I was kind of playing with fatalism and determinism and free will and all that good stuff. Also killing people.
So this kind of talking about all of the various like the shining girls as they're defined, they're very various people that Harper he's inclined to kill, as it were. And I'm very curious because all of them occur in very different social contexts, sometimes in very different their deaths and their births are in very different times, and
economic statuses.
Yeah, even race too. At different times in our history, where the, for example, the welder lives during World War II, but this is, of course, you know, she's a black woman, so it's a very different social context than, say, 1993. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious because of all the novels that I've read from you, this seems to me to be the most quote American novel. Not just because of where it's set, but in
right.
terms of the kinds of characters and the issues. And there's just so much. I don't know how you did it, but there's so much little details and components here. And I'm curious, first, sort of, what was the kind of process of preparing that much sort of historical detail and that many different components? And then second, were you at all concerned that you would not get the, quote, American context correct, or that you would maybe alienate readers by such a drastic shift in what I guess maybe people expect from Lauren Bucus, the great South African sci-fi writer?
Well, I hope that what people expect from me is that I'm going to do something unexpected. But I, yeah, you know, when I had the idea for the book that, you know, about a time traveling serial killer, and it came to me on Twitter. I was just messing around on Twitter. I was bantering with someone and I was like, you know, I should write a book about a time traveling serial killer. And I was like, oh, wait, I really should. And I very quickly deleted the tweet.
You know, I think I remember that conversation.
Yeah.
It wasn't with me, but it wasn't. But I remember seeing it at some point in time because I believe it was just an at back and forth.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I don't even know who it was with, but I quickly deleted it. And I started working on it, but you know, I knew Kirby and Harper's story, and I knew how that would resolve, and you know, how he would first come to her as a little girl and give her this My Little Pony, which hadn't been invented yet, and tell her he was going to come back and get it, and that she would survive the attack and start hunting him back. But it was the rest of the woman that kind of worked out along the way, and there was a ton of research which went into it, and so much research for like such tiny details, which might get like a sentence reference. You know, there's a moment. You guys might have had an earlier draft which didn't have this, but Zora is the African-American welder. As a young girl, she's folding paper planes on the steps outside her kind of tenement block with her little brother. And I was like, wait, did they have paper planes in 1931? And it took me like an hour to find that out. And it's one sentence. It's like half a sentence. So there was a lot of stuff which went into kind of his background throwaway details. And that one I actually outsourced to Twitter, I have to confess. You know, I just asked Twitter. I was like, help. You know, did they have paper planes? And people came back to me really quickly. but other stuff, you know, I was working with two young researchers, one in South Africa and one in America, who was checking the Americanisms for me. You know, they would find really, really interesting stuff. Like, I mean, the glow girl, who is the burlesque dancer who dances in radium paint, which, of course, is radioactive, came from a real story, that a real newspaper story that Adam found for me, Adam Maxwell. And he... I'd asked him for details like, you know, how much does a 1931 hospital cost? How would they treat a ripped tendon? Because I ripped Harper's tendon. What would the doctors wear? All that information. He sent me back a whole bunch of links and, you know, from pictures of hospitals to eBay references if I wanted to buy a crutch from 1931. But then he said, look, I've also found this article about this real life. I thought you might find this interesting, about this girl who was in hospital in 1936, who was a radium dancer. And I was like, oh my God, that is amazing. And I changed her name and I moved her back to 1931. And I actually approached the Milwaukee Sentinel to ask if I could quote from the original article. And they said, yes, and that's great because she speaks in this crazy fake French accent. She's like, the boys, they love me. Well, that's real. That's from the real article. I didn't make that up.
Wow.
I know. It was amazing. But you asked about alienating Americans and why I tackled America. It's because I was primarily interested in the 20th century and how that shaped us. And I knew if I said that in South Africa, it would immediately become an apartheid book. And that apartheid would just overshadow absolutely everything. And I wanted to talk about much more than that. I'd lived in Chicago, and it felt like a good fit. It feels a lot like Johannesburg in many ways. You know, there's a history of corruption. They've got violent crime. They've got terrible segregation historically. And, you know, so all the issues that I was already interested in were there. But then you also have this bright, shining city, and you have the birth of the skyscraper. And just really fascinating, amazing historical detail. The first nuclear fission was accomplished in Chicago at the University of Chicago under the sports field. You know, so just this amazing, fascinating, deep, rich history that I could really play with and get my teeth into.
I love that detail because I went and I was like, wait, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And then I was like, no, we're Americans. We're crazy enough. We do that.
You really did. I was desperate to get more of that in. You know, I think what was frustrating was all the stuff that I wanted to put in and just couldn't. Like, I was desperate to get more about that first nuclear reaction in, and it was artificial to kind of shoehorn it in. And the same with the Radium Girl. Her predecessors were radium painters who painted in World War One. They painted the undark watch dials, which were glow-in-the-dark watch dials. And right. I love that they're called undark. That's like my new favorite word. But they used radium paint, and every time they would put the brush in their mouths to sharpen it. So they dip it in the paint and then sharpen it with their spit. And their jaws rotted in their heads. They became honeycomb. They died horribly of just terrible radiation poisoning. And it was actually the first labor case. And I was so desperate to get this into the book, and there was just no way. There's a passing reference to it by the doctor. I just couldn't get into the depth of it. I was so frustrating. So there's a lot of stuff which is left out as well, which killed me.
Oh my goodness. Now I think, I swear that there's this podcast called Stuff You Missed in History Class, and mm-hmm. I swear they did an episode on this very thing. Because then I read that section about the radium, and you talked briefly about the court case, which mm-hmm. the people were requesting reparations basically for being exposed. And those numbers, I looked at them, I was like, those sound really familiar. And I think it is. I think it's because this Stuff You Missed in History Class actually talked about this. And it is a really fascinating, because it also reminds us of, you know, there was a time in our history when, you know, we exposed our bodies to things that nowadays we would never do.
What, you mean like airport scanners?
Oh, that's right.
Well, you know, there are all these interesting resonances with history, which were really fun to tease out. You know, I mean, obviously there's the Great Depression in 1931, which ties into the recession now. And, you know, there's an abortionist character, and that ties into the fact that women's rights to control their bodies is apparently still up for question today. I'm like, how is that possible? But also stuff like
that all the time.
I know. But, you know, also stuff like the Red Scare and the Red Scare's resonances with the war on terror and the fact that they're using fear to, you know, enable surveillance society and erode our rights. And it's really scary. And you know, the thing is, it's a novel about time travel, and it's about the loops and snarls and echoes of time travel. But the other thing which loops and snarls and echoes is history. And all that stuff comes up again and again and again. And it's crazy how much of it comes up again.
So yesterday, this is slightly unrelated except completely related, because yesterday I went to the book signing of Khaled Hosseini, who just mm-hmm. released And the Mountains Echoed. And I think the framework of his story, although obviously it's not time traveling and hopping back and forth, you know, it kind of goes through that. It's a very time sensitive novel that it's spanning across, you know, continents and different time periods and different characters, much like this novel. And I'm kind of curious now. It's like, was that something that you always... What led you to the focus, not just obviously in the time, because you've already spoken about that, but of dealing with so many different characters?
You know, I think it was important to me. Yeah, it's a mashup of a novel, And I think what makes remixes interesting, you know, if you take two genres and kind of mash them up together, mm-hmm. is that you've got to play with what makes those genres interesting, but then also kind of subvert it. And serial killer stories are typically about the serial killer. And we have this idea that serial killers are kind of sexy, Chianti-sipping, sophisticated, diabolical Hannibal Lecter types. And the more research I did into serial killers, the more I realized that that's just not true, and that actually the most interesting thing about them is the fact that they kill people. And most of them are just vile and violent losers who have impotence problems. And, you know, this is how they get off. And they often don't have much insight into why they're doing what they're doing. They don't have much of an inner life going on. So I really wanted to focus much more on the victims, which meant I wanted to get into all these stories and to look at how history has changed for these women. And they are all remarkable in their times in some way. You know, that's kind of what makes them shine, is that they're kicking back against their social context. But at the same time, I'm kicking back against the idea of, you know, the dead woman in serial killer stories as just being a victim, just being a bloody puzzle for the detective to solve. You know, too often they're just objectified. They're just dead bodies, and that's all there is to them, and that's all we know about them. And I wanted you to know who these women were and what made them special and what a loss it is to the world that they were killed. Because, you know, that's the reality of the dead woman we see on the news or the dead woman we see in crime fiction, is that they were actually, a person and that they had value. And yes. I wanted to get into that.
So one of my favorite sort of randomly interjected things is Jay, the photos from Jay.
Yeah.
of which kind of goes to the complete objectification. All it is pictures of a woman who's been murdered. Mm-hmm. And you have no context beyond that.
Yep.
Just that they're these photographs and that.
And they're
you're
kind
right.
of sexy and stylish right. and noir and yeah.
and totally inappropriate given the situation. But
absolutely.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. We do tend to objectify the victims. And we also actually tend to objectify the serial killer themselves, but in a completely different context.
But we're much more fascinated with the serial killer, and we want to know what's going on in his head.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, actually, there's not a whole lot going on in there.
No, no.
Ouch. I don't think I could actually be offended by that. No. No. I was trying to think of a context in which, like, I could justify a serial killer being upset that you said there's air in his head, but then I realized I really don't care if he's upset.
Yeah.
So.
No, absolutely. You know, it's great that Ed Gaines paints clown pictures, but you know, I don't think that makes him particularly fascinating or interesting. I think he's just a crazy psycho who paints clown pictures.
Well, you know, we want to get to the root of what makes them do what they do.
And yeah.
Sometimes there's just no particularly good reason.
Well, and there's kind of a maybe an unintentional conflict between like the public's fascination with death and destruction and murder and the kind of scientific interest in trying to discover what makes them do the things they do so that we could possibly, you know, stop it or figure out ways to treat it before it happens. I think of the TV show Law and Order SVU.
Yeah.
Sometimes actually does this. We'll have episodes where they'll have characters who haven't actually committed crimes yet. There's one great episode where this teenager, I think he's like 19, literally goes in and says, "I want to molest my young brother and I can't control myself and I need help." And the system's like, "Well, you haven't committed a crime. We can't do anything."
Well, there's that case in New York at the moment. I think it's New York, where there was a cop who'd been posting his kind of very violent fantasies about killing and eating women mm-hmm. to like a forum, but then he'd also used the fact that he was a cop to get hold of some woman's details, and he'd actually gone outside their houses, you know, and taken it that far, and that's when the cop stepped in. But I mean, you know, there's this big debate of, can you charge him? Like, you know, at what point was it going to cross into reality? Can you charge someone with having, like, you know,
future
like a
crimes?
Weird sexual fantasy? Yeah, completely.
Yeah. I don't know.
That takes you to a whole other level of science fiction.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's... Well, it goes to kind of like Minority Report with the precogs, right?
Yeah.
Predicting what you're going to do. Although I guess that's a little different because they're technically they're looking at what you actually do, but in the future, even though you haven't technically done it yet.
Yeah.
Although, I really wonder, if you just told them that they're going to kill their wife, maybe they wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm a serial killer.
I don't know. Why don't we ask Harper? That question.
So, so then we talked about the American context. We've kind of already talked about the idea of the exploring the serial killer, because obviously one of your perspectives is actually the serial killer. Mm-hmm.
And you do get inside his head, and you do kind of see his perspective, and at one point he is kind of struggling with what he's doing, which of course is typical of serial killers. You know, Son of Sam claimed he was possessed by a demon or by his dog. BTK used to write letters into the paper saying, please stop me, the voices in my head, which was, you know, a bit of a showing off call for attention, but, you know, also, you know, maybe asking for help with this compulsion. And it is a compulsion, an obsession for Harper. And he is driven to do this. And at one point he is kind of really struggling with that and trying to resist it. So maybe there's a little bit of empathy for him, but I don't know. He's an awful human being. It was good to hurt him.
I was trying to think of a redemption moment for Harper. It really isn't one in the slightest, you know. And I think it was interesting that you know, his obsession, his compulsion is both obviously of his own creation, but put on him by something else.
Mm-hmm.
As pushed off to the side that, oh, maybe it isn't his fault. It's something else's fault. And then, of course, you know, but it is still his fault, obviously, because he's a freaking serial killer.
Absolutely. And we establish him as violent before he even gets into the house. You know, he's just killed. He randomly kills some old lady because she's going to shout and raise the alarm and get him beaten up.
Yeah. Nice guy.
And that, of course, because I can't remember if he killed the guy.
A guy in a card fight, and then he's on the run from the vigilante mob, and then he finds this old lady, and he's kind of strangles her to death to stop her from raising the alarm, and he takes her coat and finds a key in the coat, which will lead him to the house, which opens onto other times, and has the wall with all these girls' names written in his handwriting.
And it's not the first, either.
Nope.
I mean, it's the first I actually sat there trying to figure out which murder at the order they actually happened in, which was the one part that that was probably the most difficult thing, because I wanted to sort of, what do you think, and then without spoiling anything, what do you think makes him kill in the order he kills in? Or is there just no particular reason for the order?
It's a loop. It's built on a paradox. So what has been will always be.
Right.
So I don't think there's, you know, obviously he starts with the glow girl, and that's what kind of kicks it off, because he sees her in the hospital. And that kind of, you know, entrenches the idea of shining in his mind. But of course, not all the girls shine is literally. It's more kind of a spark inside. And he starts with her, but in the meantime, he's been traveling, and he comes across Jin Suk, who's a social worker working in Cabrini Green, the housing project. And he's met her and seen her, and he takes the toy pony from her.
Right.
So yeah, it was really just kind of where the house leads him.
Just checking.
And that's actually the kind of move away from talking about Harper. One of your main characters, Kirby. I don't think I'm ruining anything, but I guess spoiler alert.
But it's on the back of the book that she survived.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Okay, right. So I'm not ruining anything. Yeah. Well, she's actually a survivor, and this becomes one of the kind of central, not conflict, but certainly one of the things that kind of creates her character is the fact of her survival.
It's taken over her entire life. It's actually destroyed her life. You know, if she could just get over it and let it go, she might actually be able to live an ordinary life. But, you know, there's this moment where she pulls down the scarf that hides the jagged scar across her neck where he tried to slit her throat. And she's like, how am I supposed to let this go? And, you know, how is anyone supposed to let this go? We shouldn't let violence go, because the ripples it sends out through society are just horrific. But it has overtaken her whole life. And you get hints that she might actually be happy if she could just get beyond it. But it's also how people see her. Everyone knows she's that girl. And she carries this very physical manifestation of the attack that she can't hide very well. So it's kind of a story of these twin obsessions. you know, it's Harper's compulsion to kill and her obsession to find him and stop him. And she doesn't even know that there's time travel involved. But, you know, the cops are sick of her harassing them, and she's got all these crazy theories, and she's interviewing other victims' parents, and, you know, she's really let it take over her whole life.
Poor Kirby.
I found it really interesting with her character. She shows this almost profound insight about how dialogue with other people works. You kind of mentioned it, that, you know, she'll have a discussion with somebody, and they'll start saying something, and she's like, well, I can tell he's going into that typical, I'm uncomfortable, what do? I look at the scar thing? You know, those kinds of things, or even, you know, people suggesting, well, you should read this because this will help you. They mm-hmm. don't say it explicitly, but she's, like, reading the subtext underneath it. I thought it was really interesting for her character, because, of course, it does dominate her life, but it's also a problem because so many people, from her perspective, can't seem to just look at her as a person. They constantly see what she becomes as a result of Harper.
Yeah. One of the books that I was reading at the time, because I like to read a lot while I'm writing, just to get inspiration and to relax and to see where other writers do really beautiful, amazing things and then try and appropriate that. But I was reading Jennifer Egan's Look at Me, which is about a model who has a car crash. And it kind of plays into similar themes. You know, looking at how you see a person, and the fact that she is a bit of a celebrity because of this. And actually, I had someone read an early advanced copy of the book, and he emailed me to say that that's exactly what it was like. He had a sibling who committed suicide, and the way he said it changed the way everyone treated them. They were always that family. It was the first thing which came up. You could walk into a room and you would feel the tension. And the attention, and people immediately thought that they knew something about you. And he said, you know, that really got at the heart of that. But look, we're also making it sound like a really depressing book, and I think there's also a lot of humor and lightness, especially in Kirby's relationship with Dan and Chetty.
Especially their dialogue. They have really great banter.
You know what? I had somebody accuse me of writing dialogue that was like, oh, it's so snappy and it's like so unrealistic. And then the same day I share a studio in Cape Town with some illustrators and designers. And that same day I had one of my studio mates phone me and say, oh my God, I've just finished the book. And dude, you stole all our dialogue, all our conversations.
Yeah, I'm...
If it's too witty, it's because I hang out with witty people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking this is the most realistic conversation I've ever heard. This sounds like the people that I hang out with.
Exactly.
But, we apparently hang out with cooler people.
Yeah. I think maybe people need to, you know, aspire to hang out with wittier people.
Yes, indeed.
We should set a standard.
So speaking of, you know, like how other people see her, the only one that doesn't just see her as the victim is Dan.
Yeah.
Specifically. Why Dan the character in the first place?
Well, you know, I think it's a bit of a cliche, but he's a jaded homicide reporter, but now he covers baseball. He actually couldn't handle it. He had a heart attack. It led to his divorce. He's seen a lot. He's seen it all. And she kind of reignites a spark in him. And I think he had to be a bit older. I didn't want to do the typical May-December relationship crap. You know, she's not this striking ingenue. She's deeply flawed and damaged, and so is he. And they kind of riff off each other, and they're very good for each other. And I think he's one of the few people actually capable of understanding her. Because he's seen so much, because he's seen so much horror in the world. But he's become so inured to it, and she refuses to take it lying down. She's not going to let it go. And that reignites him.
Yeah, I was madly in love with Dan by the end of
the
book.
Me too. So.
that's adorable.
I get at least one crush in every book. I was actually, I had a crush on multiple characters. But
So... out of curiosity, why baseball?
Because I don't know anything about baseball. Because I fundamentally don't understand sports or what the appeal is. And I wanted to try and get at that. You know, with Zoo City, I was writing about reconciliation because I find it very hard. I'm much more like Kirby than Zinzi, the heroine of Zoo City. you know, I find it very hard to let stuff go. You know, if you stand on my toe, whatever, or you say something nasty about me on the internet, whatever, I really don't care. Don't say nasty things about me on the internet, though. But, you know, like terrible things which happen to people and atrocities and murder and apartheid assassination squads, I can't forgive that stuff. I want those guys to rot in jail forever. So Zoo City was my way of trying to understand reconciliation and forgiveness and how you come to terms with something which you've done and a country's legacy. And this was, you know, a much smaller part of the book, obviously, but it's my attempt to understand sport. And a lot of the conversations about sport and why it matters are lifted directly from conversations I had with people, you know, trying to understand this, and specifically sports journos. So it meant I had to watch a lot of baseball games and actually figure out what was going on. And I went to the Cubs stadium to Wrigley Field. And, yeah, it was quite fun. I actually had a friend of mine, Jared Shuren from pornokitch.com, who ran the Kitschies events. I had him write a whole report that, you know, like actually Dan filed a report from the one game that they go to. And I had him write the whole thing because I was like, you know what, I've watched this game like five times. And it's an actual historical game. And Greg Maddux is a major player. And there's a little cameo from him in the scene. But I was like, I don't know what the correct terminology to use. And he helped me with that, and he actually wrote the whole scene and ended up getting cut. But anyway, you know.
That's too bad.
I know.
That was one of the really interesting things about Zoo City. It was kind of your outsourcing of...
I know, exactly. So I asked a little bit, but it got... you know, I should have it as a special feature in the ebook. It wasn't long, you know. It was like half a page. Right. But, yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, it's very unfortunate that you chose possibly the most boring American game. No offense to people who like baseball, but sitting at home and trying to watch that.
It's better than cricket, okay?
Because I disagree. And here's why I disagree. I've got a great reason why. One, they're very animated. Two, watching people in the crowd make weird faces is fun. Because there's always that one weirdo at cricket games who like stares at the camera. Yeah.
So what baseball needs is more weirdos in the audience.
Well, there's too many people in a baseball stadium. Like there, and so everybody's just weird because there's like all the like, you know, overweight guys who like take off their shirts and they like paint themselves, or maybe that's football.
So we need more specifically weird.
Yeah, like just have like a random like guy in cricket gear sit and stare at the camera.
Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, that's what would make it. No, but I mean, yeah, it's an interesting game. We'll just leave it at that.
I think baseball is horribly, horribly boring unless you're actually in person watching it with a beer in hand and a hot dog. So,
and talking to your friends instead of actually watching the game.
Exactly.
Right.
A very social experience, which is probably why Americans love it.
That's probably true. You know, you go get
a
nasty hot dog.
Violence,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, I think it also ties into history and nostalgia.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, and how people think of baseball and playing catch with your dad and that was also fun to kind of play with that. Again, with the echoes of history and what we think history is, you know, because at the moment we're very nostalgic for like the 50s, for example, you know, and I think that's all Mad Men's fault. But the 50s was not just like cupcakes and like, you know, great skirts. There was a lot of really bad shit which happened then, too.
Right. That was the other person I had a crush on, by the way, is Willie.
Yeah, Willie was so, yeah.
She's at the, God, and you really, I one of the reasons that I have to say looking forward to the show is that you really want to get to know these characters that much more.
Yeah. And I think with the show, you could really do that. You could like, you know, you could have Harper visit them again and again. I think it would have been too much in the book. Because, you know, it's bad enough that we get to know them and then I kill them.
Right.
Which is terrible. It was really, I got to the end of each chapter. I was like, really? No. But
Lauren Bucus has no problem killing our characters.
No, me and George are, we're good.
That's hilarious. Yeah, no, it's, so kind of speaking of the characters, because you have, how many girls are there? So it's what, 1, 2, they were like
9 or 10.
Yeah, and would you say that, so I was kind of trying to figure out, you know, in the context of things, of their context in both the historical moments their contacts within Harper's timeline, and then the story as a whole in terms of the progression of it. But so what made you choose? I mean, because obviously it's sort of random in terms of the loop for who he picks, but would you say that there is a progression for the story from character to character that you're going between in terms of what you're revealing about these historical moments or about various characters or about American history or whatnot?
I don't think there's a specific, or maybe not one that I'm aware of. You know, who knows what's going on in my subconscious. But I don't think there's a specific plotting out. You know, like there were certain moments in history that I wanted to tease out and play with. But the specific order that they happen in is not really relevant, I don't think. I'm going to go back and look at that now.
Right?
What was my subconscious up to when I was doing
that? What was I thinking? Yeah, I mean, because it was just one of those things that I kept kind of going, wait, is there something here? And then having to go back and be like, okay, I'm not sure. Check, check, check. But
look, I also moved them around to make sure that the objects made sense.
Right.
You know, because the objects are absolutely sequential, and that's actually the easiest way to track Harper's killing timeline is, you know, he kills Willie Rose and he takes her lighter, and then he goes to Kirby and he tosses the lighter at her body and takes the tennis ball. So, you know, that's really the easiest way of tracking it.
Well, yeah, except that it happens all out of order, so it's...
Yeah, I know, totally. But
that's if you are trying to map it out... the easiest way of tracking what order the deaths happen in.
Yes, exactly. It'd be great to do, like, you know, if ebooks became slightly more sophisticated and we could, like, release different editions. You know, like, I think the movie Memento, there's an option on the DVD where you can watch it in sequential order.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to be able to read the book in from, you know, purely Harper's order or... I'm going to speak to my publishers about that.
Well, yeah, Harper's Order, the actual historical timeline, A to Z, that would be...
Oh, that would be so weird. And like it would change how you would see character and the story and the narrative because when you're switching around how you follow it chronologically.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, because it changes, for instance, C.S. Lewis's Narnia series. There's a reason that there's like three different variations of what order that you should read the books in. And to me, it has. It changes sort of your understanding of what's going on. Or at least it changed not necessarily the understanding, it changes the experience of the stories drastically, in my opinion. But
right, because there's publication date, there is the actual chronological date, and then what's...
And then there's the date that he wrote them in, which is
awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
No.
Ooh.
This, basically, what we're saying is, like, your novel could be, like, the ultimate choose-your-own-adventure, but without the choosing. It would just be...
Right?
Yeah. I've got to say, friends of mine, they're writing, three people writing under a pseudonym, Helena S. Page, have just released I think it's coming out this month, choose-your-own-adventure erotica novel, which I think is actually really cool and exciting. It's called Girl Walks Into a Bar, and the idea is you walk into the bar and you get to pick who you're going to go home with.
Wow.
So it's really fun. So I suppose you could do a choose your own adventure serial killer novel. Who should I kill today?
But if you do it in the wrong order, bad things happen to you.
Yeah. Exactly. Definitely. I mean, you know, Harper finds that out. You know, things start going wrong.
See? You got to do it in the right order. He didn't do it in the right order.
Right order. Exactly. You can't rush
it. And he also started trying to mess around with it, you know, like trying to reverse the timelines and playing games. You shouldn't mess with time like that, dude.
Nope. He should have been watching Doctor Who.
I know. He should have stopped, you know, in the 1980s and maybe popped across to London and checked out some Doctor Who.
But alas, he did no such thing.
I know.
But hopefully he went slightly ahead of us and sees Tilda Swinton as the new Doctor Who.
That'd be so cool. Oh my God, that'd be amazing. Yeah.
Thank you. I've just decided that has to happen or the world ends. It just ends. Okay, so Shining starts. She's one of the Shining girls, in my opinion, except that she doesn't get killed. So is there something you mentioned kind of what makes them shine very briefly? Could you go into that a bit more? I mean, not in terms of Harper, but in terms of them, the characters themselves.
Well, you know, it's there are a couple of things we know about serial killers is that their MO typically gets messier and more elaborate and more violent as they go on, and that they often have a type, although apparently that's now being called into question. But, you know, Ted Bundy went for co-eds with kind of middle partings and long brown hair. And I thought, you know, I thought, okay, what if the type is not physical? What if it was something that came from within? And all of the Shining Girls are somehow different in their time. You know, they're kind of kicking back against their social context, whether that's, you know, because you're the only African American working in the war effort in a small town just outside of Chicago, or because you're a forward-thinking architect who's gay, and in a time when that is associated with being a communist, it's almost as bad as being a communist. Some of the other characters, there's an economist and an activist and just women who are kind of sparky and brave and curious. And even if they're not brave, they're kind of pushed through. When they are afraid, they'll kind of push through anyway. And it's not like any of them are going to grow up to be like the next president of the United States or whatever. It's not like Julia Madrigal, the economist, is going to stop the 2008 stock market crash. But they would make a contribution. You know, they would have some value in the world. And they stand out for who they are. They've got some bright, burning potential inside them. And Harper can't stand that.
I don't like him.
I know.
And we never get to figure out what that thing is going to be.
I know. You know, they never actually get to. Although it's interesting because Kirby only really starts to shine after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I've got one more question that's specific to the book. And
is it about my laundry?
No.
Okay.
No, we try not to air dirty laundry on the show.
Now I'm curious.
Ha ha, so funny.
Yeah. I was going to ignore the pun. Yeah, just,
I can't ignore them, sorry.
Oh, wait, apparently there's new research which shows that I was hanging out with Ed Brubaker, who wrote the Criminal series of graphic novels and Gotham Central, and you know, he's just an amazing comics writer. But he was telling me that a friend of his has done research which shows that serial killers really like puns. So you have to watch out for people who pun. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I knew it. I knew there was something about you, Jen.
Well, we have had conversations about how my younger one, you know, my daughter has accused her of being, someday she's going to be a serial killer. Because she plots, not because she's like, you know, rips the wings off of bumblebees or anything like that. She just is a plotter.
Right.
So
he did that for a good reason, though. He wanted to make sure the bumblebee could be a tightrope walker. And you can't do it with wings.
It's true.
See?
It'd be cheating.
Right, exactly. So,
yes, it's very logical. And
it's very. It makes total sense. There's nothing sadistic
cruel,
about that at all.
Sadistic. And yeah, sure. Okay, we'll go with that.
All right, Sean, what was your actual question?
Sure. We've kind of, like, touched on it sort of, but you obviously, anybody who looks at, like, your Wikipedia page knows that you are yourself a journalist and have a fairly noted one in your native home of the faraway land, magic land of South Africa. That's a terrible way to put it.
It's a great way to put it.
but as a noted journalist, obviously this has influenced perhaps even your researching. But since one of your characters, not just in Zoo City, we had sort of an amateur sleuth, but now we have actual, like, proper journalists and a bit of amateur sleuthing. How would you say that your experience as a journalist has sort of influenced the way you develop these characters?
Well, it comes down to a couple of things. There's right, you know, I write what you know, and also write what you don't know, which is why there's baseball. But yeah, it's I feel like I have to go to a place. The new book is set in Detroit. I did a research trip there, and although I'd lived in Chicago, I went back for The Shining Girls to do a research trip to visit the actual locations. I went to Montrose Beach where Kirby is attacked. I went into the back corridors of the Congress Hotel. I went to the Fisher Building where Willie Rose is murdered, and it just adds a layer of texture, that detail just makes it more real. And I think especially if you have a crazy conceit like a time-traveling serial killer, or in Zoo City, you know, criminals with magical animals, if you've got that kind of ridiculous high-concept conceit, you have to make it more real. And the way to do that is with the real details. And I interviewed a police detective, and I interviewed a music journalist, and I went to the zine museum to look at, like, the different zines which Kirby was kind of aspiring to write for. And yeah, you know, I think journalism, it's a way of, it's I think it's the closest thing to being a cop without being an actual cop. Because you're going out and you're interviewing people and you're trying to piece a story together from all these contrasting and, often contradicting stories. And trying to get the bigger picture and that big perspective. So it's definitely influenced both the way I write and the kind of characters I write. And the new book has a cop, but also a blogger who's kind of in that same kind of role. And I don't know if I'll ever quite be able to get away from that. It's I think it's just part of who I am.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, so last two questions. One is just a simple question, and the other is a reference to another thing you've done, which is you wrote the foreword to the 2013 edition of Vert by Jeff Noon.
I did.
And I found that was very exciting. It's the 20th anniversary edition. If nobody has read Vert, it's kind of like a dark cyberpunk. I don't know how to describe it. It's been a while since I read it, about 10 years now almost. I read it for college, but I do recommend everybody read it. But what was it like writing the foreword to that book?
It was so intimidating. I wanted to die. So I outsourced. I'm good at outsourcing, as we mentioned with Zoo City, where I got some other people to write some chapters. So I asked my writer friends, from William Gibson to Warren Ellis, and I got a list of some other people who knew Jeff Noon as well, to just write about what they thought of his work and what kind of an impact it had on them. And Jeff Noon has this thing where he does a remix. He'll take an existing text and kind of mash it up. And so I got all these kind of all this input from other writers and about how Jeff Noon meant to them and what Vert had meant to them. And then I mashed it up into kind of this crazy, weird, strangeness. And I think that's very Noon. I think it was kind of the best tribute I could have done to him. I hope. I don't actually know what he thinks of it. I hope he likes it. He's been very sweet to me in person. We met in Brighton, and he was just lovely. He's actually got a new book out as well, Channel Skin.
Oh, yeah, I need to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a very fascinating character, so.
He is. He's absolutely amazing. And the book is so strange and wonderful and dark. And, you know, you take these feathers which transport you into kind of a virtual world, but there are layers of different worlds. And I didn't realize until I reread it how much of that kind of base DNA had leaked into Moxieland, my first book. I was actually a bit mortified. I was like, oh my god, Moxieland is basically Vert fanfiction. Or at least the first couple of chapters.
It happens, though, when you read a work that influences you. Like, I wrote stuff after reading that book, too, which I think will be obvious, not as fanfiction. At least I hope it doesn't look like fanfiction.
Well, you know, but I think maybe it starts out as fan fiction and you find it and you find your own voice. But I think we all start out actually writing fan fiction, you know, like whether that's Hemingway or Jeff Noon. You know, you're aspiring to write in a certain style and about certain things. And you write like that for a bit and then hopefully you find your own voice.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I have many voices and they all speak to me.
Well, I figured this from early in the podcast that you have many people inside your head. So.
Yeah, all these imaginary people. That's why I have to kill them.
Yeah, obviously.
People stop talking.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, well, that would explain the number of women that get killed in this novel.
Yep. That's also how you tell a good author is if they're slightly mental and they have multiple personalities in their head.
Oh, yeah.
Although I come across as quite well-adjusted in person. But, you know, you don't know the dark, seething depths underneath.
Well, I mean, all authors except for Thomas Pynchon are pretty well-adjusted in public.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a couple that aren't. They're a little nutty, but
yeah.
They don't sell quite as well.
No, well, Thomas Pynchon's, like, the last recluse author that can get away with it now.
Yeah.
Oh. That's something to aspire to, Lauren.
But I like being on Twitter too much. You know, it's bad enough I have the voices in my head, I have the voices on my screen as well.
Okay, so the last thing we'll ask you is just a fairly straightforward thing. You are on your U.S. book tour now.
Which is why I have laundry.
Yeah.
And that means you're going to have quite a few stops, so instead of having you try to go through all of them, tell people where they can find you online, and then where specifically they can go to find out all of your tour dates, like where you're going to be, all that stuff.
Absolutely. Well, my website is laurenbukes.com, which is B-E-U-K-E-S. And if you go laurenbukes.com/schedule, you'll get to my tour dates. It's, let me see if I can remember. It's Scottsdale, San Francisco, Portland, Chicago, DeKalb, Houston, New York.
So you're not coming to the South?
No, I'm sorry.
Nobody does.
It's not fair. It's not fair.
Yeah, well,
I'll cry.
Move somewhere decent.
Yeah, like South Africa.
Yeah.
I would like to visit.
It's really cool. It's really cool.
It's just going to cost me like $15 billion to fly there, but...
Probably.
But my grandma has relatives there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my grandma's South African.
Cool.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I like it.
So there's another question then. Do you have any conventions that you're going to in the next year that people can...
I'm going to the Harrogate Crime Festival, and I'm going to the Edinburgh Festival, and I'm going to World Fantasy. And I might try and come back for New York Comic Con, because my comic, Fairest, The Hidden Kingdom, which is about, it's basically Rapunzel does Japanese horror.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It's pretty cool. So the trade paperback will be out in July, actually. So I might come back for New York Comic Con if I can. I also have another book to write in between, and all this travel is killing. Although much easier than writing. You know, if I could just travel then and pretend to write. I need clones. Except I suspect my clones wouldn't just set up their own Twitter accounts and mess around as much as I do.
Well, awesome. So everybody should go to your website, and they should buy The Shining Girls. It will be out the day we release this.
Do not wait for the TV show have with Game of Thrones.
It's much shorter.
Sean, read it.
Well, I read this before the show would...
I'm talking about Game of Thrones.
Whatever, man.
You totally missed that.
It's evil.
Still very good.
But anyways, go check out The Shining Girls, and also her other great works, Moxie Land and Zoo City would be the most recent, and her website, and find out if she's going to be near you so you can go get a book and have it signed, and maybe listen to her read and all that kind of good stuff. So
she has a very mesmerizing voice, obviously.
You will give me all your money. Not working? Damn it.
you're not turning into one of those was it 419 scammers?
Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show with us again. It was really awesome.
Thank you, and I'm glad we could coordinate the time zones. It's always fun chatting to you guys.
Yeah, so we will see everybody next week with whatever. I don't know what we're doing next week, so
we'll figure something out.
Yeah.
<All right. laughs>
Bye.
Awesome. Bye. Thanks, guys. Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.